I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. In late October of 2012, Hurricane Sandy, unofficially known as Superstorm Sandy, was churning her way up the eastern seaboard. Measured by diameter, she became the largest Atlantic hurricane on record, with winds spanning 1,100 miles. At least 286 people were killed in seven countries along the path of Sandy. The death toll would have been higher had it not been for a heroic rescue of 14 sailors on the tall ship HMS Bounty, which found her way right into the path of the storm. Michael Togas is the author of numerous books on disaster and survival at sea. His latest book chronicles the events aboard the Bounty and the ultimate rescue of her crew by the U.S. Coast Guard. It's titled Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy, which he co-wrote with Douglas Campbell. He joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Mindy.
I always know when I pick up one of your books, it's going to be a page turner. It's just amazing, these survival stories that you find. This story made news headlines, and there were even images of the ship awash in the hurricane force seas on all the major news networks. The question everyone asked at the time was why? Why did the ship set sail right into the path of a forecasted hurricane? Is that one of the answers you hope to find when you set out to write the book?
Definitely. That was the key answer of why. And it was a challenge finding out why, but having a co-author sure helped, you know, because we interviewed a lot of people who knew the captain, family members of the captain, people who were on the vessel that day, and we began to put the pieces together.
And you heard about the story during Sandy, right?
Yep. As a strange coincidence, I was on Fox and Friends, and I was specifically on to talk about this approaching hurricane, and they asked me, could any ships be out at sea in its path? And I said, absolutely not. This storm has been so well forecast and hyped up, and there's no way. And then I got home, and the next day, I see, oh my God, the Bounty's in trouble.
Yeah. So you knew this was a story I have to get on, find out what happened.
Yeah. But at first I thought, wow, what a terrible tragedy. I don't know if I want to do a book that's kind of a downer, but then as I began to investigate the rescue, I began to realize, hey, there was a miracle here.
Absolutely.
Anybody was saved.
Yeah. You were able to interview both the crew of the Bounty and the Coast Guard personnel involved in the rescue. How willing were all of they to share their stories?
Not all of the crew wanted to do that. A few had been actually burned on a morning talk show on television where they thought they were going to be on for a half hour, and it went down to like a soundbite. So they were kind of leery of journalists in general. So we were able to interview about half the crew, but we had access to what the other crew members had to say via the Coast Guard inquiry. Mm. That went on for a whole week, so there was just reams of testimony.
Right. Tell us more about the ship itself.
Well, the Bounty was built in 1960 for the movie with Marlon Brando, and a lot of people say, oh, it was just a movie prop, but it was a well-constructed ship built in Nova Scotia, and they actually sailed it to Tahiti for the movie. It was supposed to be burned at the end of the movie, just like what happened to the real Bounty, and Marlon Brando said, no, I walk off the set. If you burn that ship, he'd fall in love with it. So went through different owners. Ted Turner had it for a while. The city of Fall River had it for a while. And then at the time of this accident, it was owned by a private businessman from Long Island.
Hmm. And tell us the parameters of this. It looked like an old pirate ship, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was used in two of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. It was 160 feet long. That includes the bowsprit. So it was a little bigger than the original Bounty, but in every other way, it was built to be a replica of that ship. But it had some modern things as well. It had the latest weather technology. It had EPIRBs, which are the emergency beacon. It had two propellers, two engines, pumps, so things that you wouldn't have had on the original Bounty.
Right. And the fact that she could sail, that was partly because the film with Marlon Brando, they wanted to shoot that in Tahiti, and they knew that. So they needed something that could sail from Nova Scotia to Tahiti. Now, prior to heading south that fall, the Bounty was hauled out in a shipyard in Maine, and some rot was found.
Yes.
There wasn't time or resources to repair the rotten wood. And when the vessel set sail from the shipyard in Maine, the advice from the shipyard was, avoid heavy weather. It doesn't sound as though this vessel was in the best of shape at that time.
That is absolutely correct. They were in Boothbay Harbor to replace the caulking between the planks on the hull. And in that process, they found more significant rot. It was actually woodworms, which I'd never seen before. But I saw a piece that they cut out from the bound, and it looked like you take a drill right through it. Mm. So the captain was aware of that, and they didn't have time to make those repairs. And I'm not sure, they may not have had the funds. That was never really clear. But they set sail. And they went from Booth Bay with a couple stops and ended up in New London as this. And that's when they learned of this approaching hurricane.
Also sounded like the captain, Captain Robin Walbridge, was thrifty, I guess. I mean, sometimes in some of the repairs, choosing some of the more inexpensive, which do you think that had anything
very well to, might have, especially with the caulking. They didn't use the highest grade caulking. They bought some at a Home Depot or a Lowe's. That really wasn't even meant for this purpose. And, you know, so, yeah, it was an old ship that needed a lot of work, and they had put some in, but not all.
Which is one of the reasons Fall River wanted to sell it. I mean, they loved having it, but the upkeep of a ship like that is really expensive.
Yeah, all wood.
Yeah.
And remember, what, 60 years old, so...
It needs something all the time. Right?
Exactly.
So this storm, well forecast, and Captain Walbridge discussed the impending weather with the crew and even gave them the option to leave the ship before she set sail. Talk a little about the culture and community on these sailing vessels and why that would have been difficult for the crew to leave.
Robin gathered the crew on the deck before they left New London, and by that time, the crew was aware of this approaching hurricane, maybe not as knowledgeable about it as Robin was, but he said, here's your opportunity. I know some of you are concerned about the hurricane. If you want to leave the ship, no hard feelings. You can meet us in St. Petersburg. That was their destination for an event. And it was a crew of 15, and then Robin would make 16. No one stepped off, whereas I would have said, you know, see you later. Yeah. I'll take the train. You know?
Yeah.
And I thought about that a lot, and I later came to the conclusion that there were two factors of why they all went. One was the crew was mostly young people, and I thought back, what would I have done in my 20s? I might have looked to see what my friends were doing, and if nobody was bailing out, I might have wanted to be part of this and not be the one to let them down. And Robin didn't really give them a lot of time to think about it. Had he said, you know, take an hour or two, maybe the answers would have been different. But they had to make almost a split decision. And being young and being part of the team, I heard that word a few times, that we were a team, they all said, we're with you. Right. And they trusted him.
And Captain Walbridge tried to reassure many that the ship is safer at sea than in port. Explain what he meant by that. Why would it be safer at sea?
Well, he was talking just about the ship, not about the crew. Mm-hmm. But rather than being up on a pier or a dock getting hammered by the waves into the wooden pilings, you could ride out a storm at sea. And that's kind of that old culture of the tall ships. But you know, the crew's always safer if you're right on land. So to me, that made little sense.
And he had options. I mean, there were things he could, I mean, he could have sailed to New Bedford behind the, you know, the wall. I mean, there were options that could have, would have seen, and even the first mate, I think, was the one who raised to the captain saying, you know, have you thought about these other options?
Exactly. First mate John Swenson gave him some of those options to think about, and it looked like Robin had the schedule in the back of his head to be at St. Petersburg for this event, because it might have put the Bounty in a new direction, and it did need funds, and he probably wanted to see if we can't make a go of that. But having done six of these kind of books, schedules get you killed when you're doing anything with an element of some risk.
Yeah. Now, the captain did have a plan for how the Bounty would avoid the dangerous side of the hurricane. So talk about where the dangerous side of the hurricane is and what the captain's plan was.
Well, he had been on a cable television station earlier that spring, and the the interviewer actually asked him, what about hurricanes? And he said, oh, Bounty loves hurricanes. And the interviewer said, what do you mean? And Robin said, well, we like to get behind them, and that way we stay behind them, never in front, and we'll get the following winds if we're in the proper quadrangle. And yet, with this trip in Superstorm Sandy, he does just the opposite. He's not behind the storm. He's going towards it and then cuts right in front of its path. So there are many of his decisions that didn't add up to his knowledge and expertise, because he was quite knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. And when they made the decision to change course, they had gone maybe 300 miles south after they left New London. And by then, they had the latest weather information, and they could see this storm was going to make a direct hit on them. So they had to make a move. One option might have been maybe go due west into Chesapeake Bay. Another one might have been race towards Bermuda, or just head north again, get away from it. But he makes the choice of going to the, let's see, the southwest. And in an email back to his home base, he says, we think we can squeak by the hurricane by going to the southwest. So far, the ship's doing pretty good.
Do you think he didn't have an idea of just how much area this storm was covering? Because that was not a typical hurricane.
Right. You know, it was the largest in terms of the width and the breadth.
Do you think he wasn't aware of that?
No, I think he was aware of it, but way too late.
Way too late, yeah. Because when you, one of the things I was surprised reading is as they're you know, shipping out, and you're looking at what the other weather service folks are, I can't remember the first guy name, he was telling his clients, here's what's happening,
yes.
But that the Bounty was not a client of it. And then there's Herb, whose last name is escaping me, who does the service for this for sailors for free.
Why
you wouldn't take advantage of this free weather service, I don't understand. I guess that perplexed me that they were not, he wasn't listening to any of those forecast.
If anything, he was so overconfident, having gone through, not gone through a couple hurricanes, but been out at sea and doing what he said earlier, being behind a hurricane and following it. But this was so different and just overconfidence.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the maneuverability of a traditionally rigged vessel such as the Bounty. She can only sail in certain directions relative to the wind, right?
Yeah, but this one with the two propellers on it could make some changes, and they were really making the ship work hard. They, you know, when they started to feel the effects of the storm, and the storm was still to the south, they took down all the sails because the wind was just too much and the waves are building. So they were relying on the two screws. But meanwhile, the water is building down in the bilge, and they're realizing the pumps cannot keep up. And I always thought that was a critical point in this whole event, that as soon as you realize the pumps aren't keeping up, either alert the Coast Guard or, better yet, alert the Coast Guard and head towards Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
And they did neither in the beginning. They were just trying to solve the problem.
And they were having trouble with the pumps before they even set out on the sail.
It's true. A couple of the crew members, when they left Booth Bay, they could reverse the pumps so that they could hose down the deck. And they reported to the captain, they're just not as powerful as usual. Something seems to be amiss with the pumps. And he acknowledged that, but again, did not address it.
So as mentioned, equipped with two diesel engines, but even with those engines running, she probably would have had trouble making any miles in those really powerful headwinds and seas. I mean, just the description of the seas, you think of them kind of going in one direction. They were going in all directions. It was like complete chaos.
Yeah, and a lot had to do with them being on the perimeter of the Gulf Stream, I'll talk about that a little bit later. But the waves were coming from different angles every now and then, and Robin actually was the first person to be injured because of those freak waves. He was thrown into a table in the great room at the stern of the ship and injured his back. But by this time, now, everything's starting to go wrong. So he can't even nurse his back. Every hand is needed.
Talk about what the forecasters were saying about this storm, because everybody else seemed to listen. The Bounty was the only ship out there.
Right.
So what were the forecasters saying?
When they left port, he had access to a weather map. I use it in my presentation so the reader, the audience, can see what he had access to. And when he left New London on Thursday, the map showed this low-pressure system that had turned into a hurricane down in the Caribbean, and then a projected path coming basically up the eastern seaboard and then curling towards land somewhere from, say, Maryland all the way up to Maine. And it turned out that was pretty accurate. You know, it curled in towards New Jersey. So he had access to the projections. Now, did they know how wide this was going to be? Probably not. They knew it was going to be big, but not the biggest one ever in terms of breadth.
Yeah.
And Robert, so by the time he acknowledged all this and the ship was in trouble, he was really out of options.
Yeah, and he didn't share what he knew with the crew.
No, some of the crew told me they didn't even know we changed course.
Yeah, it's wild. We're talking with Michael Togus, who along with Douglas Campbell wrote Rescue of the Bounty. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Michael Togus, who along with Douglas Campbell wrote Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. Once the Bounty leaves New London on Thursday, October 25th, it doesn't take long for some of those mechanical systems on board to start malfunctioning. We mentioned the bilge pumps are supposed to pump out excess water. They're having trouble keeping a prime. We knew that was happening.
Right.
So all of a sudden, they start having, you know, little trouble here, little trouble, and it starts adding up.
Yes, this compounding of problems. For example, the cook was trying to do her work, and then you'd get a power surge, and sparks would come from an electrical outlet. Lights were flickering on and off. They've just got one problem after another, and the water isn't just coming in from the hull, from where they did the caulking. It was coming in from the deck as well, because waves are starting to wash over the deck. People were in their bunks getting wet as it came down through the ceiling.
Yeah, it sounds like an awful situation.
And they were exhausted, too. So exhaustion also plays a role in decision-making as well.
Talk about the cook. This was her first trip.
I can't imagine being on a first trip on something like
and
this.
And being as calm as she was, a cook, you know, and through it all, she sounds like she's in there just making what she can.
Right,
and
was,
you know,
thinking ahead to when the power goes out, make a bunch of mac and cheese now so they have something to eat, because these people are running on fumes, no sleep. And the other person on board who I always, my heart went out to, was Claudine Christian, who was a descendant of Fletcher Christian from the original Bounty. And she was not an experienced tall ship person. In fact, this was her first summer on a tall ship. And she, of all the crew members, she had the most misgivings about this voyage, because her parents shared her emails with me, and as soon as they left New London, she was starting to have second thoughts. One email said, we're going to have to sail all the way to Europe to get away from this thing. And then as they went further along, she even said, if something should happen to me, know that I'm doing what I love, and I'm happy, and I love you. So
she's thinking the worst.
Yeah, the worst.
Yeah. And why do you think she decided to go ahead on the trip?
Boy, I do think it was the group dynamics, you know, not wanting to let the others down. Because they were at a bare-bones crew, had two people opted out. Really, they shouldn't have left. That didn't happen. So they were at a bare-bones. So if anybody dropped out, the whole trip could be in jeopardy. And she probably, being the newcomer,
didn't
want to
be that
the one.
Person, yeah.
And on the other hand, if you're a crew member and you have little experience, like say I'm on board, I don't have experience on tall ships, I'd listen to the captain.
Yeah,
he's been doing it for years.
Let's talk a little about the captain. Talk about his prior experience and his reputation.
We mostly heard positive things in terms of his reputation. A great teacher, we would hear that time and time again, very good problem solver. But I think all of that led to his overconfidence, such as that interview where he said, oh, we like hurricanes, you know, kind of making it sound like a walk in the park. And Bounty's been in big seas before, 50 feet, and did just fine. Well, he was talking about swells, because there's no way the Bounty could be in breaking seas that big. So a little bit cavalier, that probably came from that overconfidence of being a captain. He was a captain on board the Bounty for 11 or 12 years.
Mm. Really motivated and focused man. I mean, even from childhood, you write about in childhood, he knew what he wanted and he went for it, even as a kid.
Yeah, he was an unusual. He grew up in Vermont, and he did some long-haul trucking. And then what he did was he started buying properties and rehabilitating them, made some money there, and then said, okay, I made a bunch of money. Now I'm going to do what I love. And his love was the sea, and was primarily self-taught, just one of those people.
Yeah, interesting guy. And it was interesting, as you say, most of the people, you know, really trusted him, thought he had good judgment, like you said, good problem solver. But there were a couple of guys who were on a trip to Puerto Rico, I think it was, and they got off in Puerto Rico. Tell us their story.
Yeah, they thought this captain was crazy, that he pushed the envelope way too far, and we're not going to go back with him on the return trip. And some other tall ship people said, yeah, the Bounty was kind of like, there were some renegades on board kind of thing. You know, they had a certain swagger to them that they really believed that they and the ship could do just about anything.
So as things go from bad to worse, the weather deteriorates Friday night into Saturday. The generators that provide power to the ship start to have trouble running. And those, of course, provided power to the pumps.
Right.
So things are getting bad.
Bad.
The ship is rolling a lot as the seas build. And Captain Walbridge, as you mentioned, becomes injured after he's launched against a table. After his accident, Captain Walbridge seems to step down mentally from his role as leader, and the chief mate steps in. Talk a little bit about that.
John Svensson was very experienced. He was the one who tried to talk the captain out of this trip in the first place. And he was the first to recognize, we're never going to get these pumps to keep up. We should alert the Coast Guard. They're not in a mayday, but he's thinking, we should alert the Coast Guard to where we are and the nature of our problem. And when he says that to Robin, Robin goes, I think our time's better spent solving the problem. But then a couple more hours go by, and it's clear. They're taking on a foot of water per hour, and Robin sends an email to his home base that he wanted forward to the Coast Guard. And he basically says, pumps aren't keeping up with the water. Here's our position. We think we're going to be fine through the night. This is Sunday night now, and Monday is a big event in terms of the storm. But he ends that email with a curious line. He says, but the ship's doing great. And so when the Coast Guard got that email, they're like, what do you mean? Taking on a foot per hour, but the ship's doing great. But they had no direct communication with him. The email had gone down. So they have a difficult decision. How do we get comms, communication with them? And should we launch a C-130 search plane? Yeah. And ultimately, I like what the Coast Guard did. They left it up to the aircraft commander of the C-130 to decide how far into the hurricane.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's a dangerous mission for them, too.
Exactly.
What's interesting, though, is that the chief mate, he had gotten off a satellite phone call to the office in Long Island. He wasn't sure that it got through, but it does. And the message is relayed to the Coast Guard. So he sends out the note, they talk to the C-130 team, and they decide, yeah, maybe we should go and check this out.
Right. And their main reason is to make direct radio communication and find out just how bad this is going to be. Should we be preparing for a rescue in the morning? Nobody's thinking about a rescue at night because it's so dangerous with the hurricane.
Right. And the captain believed they would make it till morning.
Yes.
He had said that. Now, give us a sense of the physical condition of the crew at this point. Sleep deprived, scared, also physically exhausted. They're working hard. They're getting beaten up. Two of the crew, including the captain, are pretty seriously injured.
Right. Adam Prokash had cracked vertebrae in his back and a broken collarbone. Again, just from a wave knocking you into a bulkhead. They all performed really well in terms of working together in that exhausted state and doing what had to be done. And then eventually they and the captain came to the conclusion, we're never going to get these pumps to work properly. We don't want to be trapped below should something happen. And the decision is made to get in survival suits, and there are plenty of survival suits on board.
But it seemed like it took a while for that, because the captain was saying, well, let's get the survival suits out. If we need them, we'll make that call. He seemed to kind of
almost in denial.
For where you're going, what do you mean? I wouldn't want that thing on right now. You know, if you were there, you would think. I also thought it was, you talk about the teamwork of the crew. They really did pull together, and they really gave it their all. I'm thinking even going back to the cook, who comes up and she's like, how can I help?
Right.
You know, I mean, she's the cook.
Right. There wasn't a single person that panicked. Claudine did a great job as well, you know, helping wherever she could. She helped the injured crewmen. And so they get in the survival suits, and they don't want to be caught below deck. So they line up on the starboard side of the ship. And they've got a good plan. It's just, we're going to wait till morning. And unless some miracle happens, we're probably going to have to abandon ship. But we're not going to try to do that at night.
Right. So it becomes clear to the Coast Guard pilots on the C-130 that the Bounty might not stay afloat until dawn. And they alert helicopter crews at Air Station Elizabeth City, New Jersey, to get ready. Talk a little bit about that communication between the C-130 and the crew on the ship. They're talking back and forth, and the pilot is, you know, bringing the C-130 up. I mean, these waves are huge, so they're trying not to get caught in some of these giant waves. So they're coming up 7,000 feet down to 500, kind of coming back, and they're chatting with them for a while. This is so now they're
forming this bond.
This bond, yeah. Talk about that.
Yeah, Wes McIntosh was a C-130 pilot. Oftentimes in books like this, people give all the attention to the helicopter teams, but the C-130 aircraft is important too. And there was one comment Wes made I'll never forget. He said, a wind gust hit our aircraft so hard, it threw us up 300 feet. And then as it passed, we dropped like a stone 200 feet. And with my night vision goggles, I could see the wings flex by 5 feet.
That's amazing.
And he said, it was just incredible. But he said, we did figure eights above the Bounty and kept reassuring them every 20 minutes. Are you okay? We're still here. We're going to be with you throughout the night as long as our fuel holds out. And the plan was just that, stay out there through the night and then at dawn launch a helicopter just in case anything bad should happen. But they never got that chance.
No, so they say, okay, listen, that we need to get a helicopter crew out here now. And they needed another C-130 because they were running out of fuel.
Right.
They wanted to stay, but if they stayed, they would be in trouble themselves.
Right.
So,
and but going back to what you said earlier, they really did, the C-130 crew really did form a bond with the Bounty because they're on the radio with them for 2 or 3 hours talking and trying to lift their spirits. And then suddenly they hear, abandoning ship, and click.
And then no communication.
Nothing. Yeah. And Wes said, on the aircraft, we couldn't believe it. You know, we kept going, Bounty, come in, Bounty, come in. And he said, we dropped from 3,000 feet, you know, as low as possible, and through the night vision goggles could not believe what we saw. He said the ship was on its side, the tops of the masts were sticking out and they were broken off, water was washing, you know, you couldn't see the deck, the deck was underwater. And then he said to me, he said, we saw 30 blinking strobe lights. And I'm like, 30? There was only 16 people on board. And he's saying, Mike, I saw 30 at least. And I think what it was empty survival suits.
Because they had
extras. Strobes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Water-activated strobes.
Boy, talk about a tough rescue scene. So the Bounties we mentioned, equipped with these emergent suits that the crew had put on. Describe what these suits are.
Well, the emergent suits, they also call them Gumby suits because they don't have fingers oftentimes, but they're neoprene and they're meant to keep you warm. Even though they're near the Gulf Stream and the water's warm, the water's going to have to be, you know, in the 90s for you to survive. So they put on the survival suits, and one thing that came out in my research was probably because they thought they were going to make it to morning, maybe they didn't zip them up all the way, you know, right up to your nose. They sometimes can zip, so just your nose and eyes are sticking out. Because that becomes a big problem later because a lot of water came into the survival suit.
Gets heavy,
yeah, and it collects down at your legs, the lowest point.
Yeah. So not only are they being tossed into immense seas with hurricane force winds, and as we mentioned, these waves that are just going every direction and they're enormous, they also have to contend with not getting caught in the running or standing rig of the ship, probably one of the most dangerous situations at sea that they could find themselves in.
Yeah, when the ship suddenly went over, some of the crew was tossed into the water, some were on the vessel, and the ones in the water said the masts were rising up and then slamming down, up and slamming down. So if you can picture from, you know, this 45-degree angle coming down and slapping the water, and you're trying to dodge it.
Oof, yeah. And then there's debris.
Yeah, I mean, rope line everywhere.
And there was, you know, you talk about some of the stories, and I can't remember which ones, but where they do, one guy does get caught in some of that rigging, and he thinks he's going to drown.
Exactly.
And by some miracle, he happens to get free. But what I just can't even imagine, after all they've been through, as exhausted as they are, and now here they are fighting for their lives.
And this is all at night, too.
In the seas. the water was relatively warm, but you're saying that's great if you're in for 5 or 10 minutes, but it was about 70 degrees,
yes,
the waters?
Correct.
Yeah. But with those howling winds and crises. All right, so now they're trying to figure out how to get to life rafts.
Yes, they located the life rafts, were able to, you know, jerk the tether, that the CO2 cartridges, fill it up. And as they try to get in, they realize they can't because so much water is collected in the legs of their survival suit, they can't get inside. It's like 500-pound legs. So it took them about an hour. And they finally, what they did was they got the smallest person, and everybody kind of pushed on their butt,
got
that
up
small
there.
Person, yeah. Get that person in, and then that person could help the next and the next. So two groups formed up, a group of six in one life raft and a group of seven in the other. But that left three people on their own, and that was the captain, Claudine, and the first mate.
Yeah. Just before the ship broaches, the chief mate was able to relay that to the C-130 and that they were abandoning ship. And we mentioned that the Coast Guard organizes to drop those life rafts to them. And we should mention that because you got to think about this. What are these guys flying in and where's it going to go? I mean, that in itself, it seems like an impossible task to actually get those to where they need to be.
It was with those winds, and you could imagine opening the cargo doors. But the C-130 dropped two rafts. They did get, you know, in the vicinity. But it turned out it wasn't necessary because the Bounty had two large life rafts.
But these C-130 guys and gals, they were doing their best to help them get where they need to go. We are talking with Michael Togas, who along with Douglas Campbell wrote Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Michael Togas, author of Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy, the book he wrote with Douglas Campbell. I think we were talking about being in the water in these wild conditions, the waters being churned by the sea, that even if your head is above water, there's so much spray. It's really difficult to breathe. I mean, if you go under and you're coming up and you're trying to catch your breath, I just can't even imagine the struggle that they were going through.
Foam and spray, you're probably breathing that in. And you've got the current as well because of the Gulf Stream. I hate to jump ahead, but the rescue swimmer said he...
I was thinking the swimmers too.
He never had experienced anything like it. He said, I'm used to the waves pushing me along. He said, here, the current's taking me right into the seas.
Yeah, it's crazy. So the Coast Guard sends out the first rescue helicopter. And much more dangerous than the C-130 flying this. The C-130, it's dangerous as it is, sending a helicopter in this at night. This is really scary stuff. We've had helicopters and crews lost in similar situations like this. So it's not just, as we say, in the wind we have to worry about. It's the seas. A rogue wave could knock that helicopter right out of the air. Talk about flying helicopters in this kind of weather and how they make sure they're going to have enough fuel to return, because this is kind of a tough thing to figure out.
They always do a calculation both while they're going out and on scene of what they call their bingo. That's the time we have to leave no matter what. They will have just enough fuel to get back. And the pilot of the first helicopter, incredibly, had just a year and a half earlier been in a helicopter crash and almost lost his life. He was told he may never walk again. So here he is, he's back recertified to fly, and his first big mission is to go into Superstorm Sandy and rescue this tall ship Bounty. Of all the rescues that the poor guy had to do. But I think in retrospect, he was the perfect guy because he wasn't going to push the envelope. He was going to make sure that they left when they hit their bingo. They weren't going to, you know, stay 2 or 3 minutes more. And that is what happened. They left.
So the C-130 that had been circling the Bounty has been keeping track of, and this is the second one, of the life rafts and the flashing strobe lights that are affixed to those immersion suits. So the pilots notice one light looks different from the others, and they send the helicopter to that first.
Yeah, the helicopter crew was surprised. Like, why aren't we going to the life rafts? And why aren't, you know, they already had been on scene, and the C-130 directs them far from the Bounty to this one lone strobe. And the rescue swimmer, I'm skipping a lot, he made several false attempts, but finally the rescue swimmer got to this strobe, and it was John Svensson, the first mate. And I've never met him, but I think he's the luckiest guy on the planet.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't go
along
there first,
he
would have drifted miles
away. Yeah, he had already started to suffer from hypothermia at this point.
Yeah, and he had an injury as well.
Randy Haba, is that how you say his name?
Randy
was the rescue swimmer. So talk about what his job is.
Well, he's going to be at the doorway of the helicopter and be hooked to the cable, and they're going to slowly lower him. And when he hits the water, he's going to release from the cable, swim to the survivor or the life raft, whatever.
Which sounds
it may
easy,
be.
But think about those waters.
Yeah, and again, I'm you know, in Rescue of the Bounty, we wrote that it took him 6 attempts.
Right.
It wasn't as simple as I'm kind of making it sound. But when he gets to the survivor, what happens is the hoist operator back in the helicopter will have retracted the cable, attached the basket. The basket's big enough for one. Lower that down, and the rescue swimmer will stuff the first survivor into it. And so the rescue swimmer stays down in the water. He's not on the hook, not on the cable, while that survivor comes up.
And then waiting to go to the next one.
Waiting, and that's when the rescue swimmer is really vulnerable because there's no way to get him back in the aircraft if there's a problem. He's off the hook.
So then the helicopter proceeds to the life rafts, and then the rescue swimmer, his work really begins. He has to take each survivor individually from the raft to the basket.
Yep.
And you get to that first raft, and they took all but 3?
Exactly.
Right. So imagine you're the 3 left in there. They're going, hey, wait, where are you going? Because now, bingo, we got to go.
Yeah, they didn't know what happened. Did the helicopter crash? Did they not know we're here? And what really happened was back in the Hilo, the aircraft commander, the one who'd been in the crash a year and a half earlier, said, we are leaving. And Randy goes, we can't. There's still 3 people down there. And the aircraft commander goes, no, it's bingo. We're going. RTB, return to base. There'll be another helicopter later.
Right. So a second helicopter came on the scene with Daniel Todd was the rescue swimmer. He proceeded to get the other Bounty crew from that life raft to the basket.
Right.
And God bless him, boy. Not only did he get those, but all the others in the other. And this was, I can't believe he had the strength to do this. I think he must have been going on pure adrenaline.
He said it was like swimming through mud. He was doing a doggy paddle. He could barely swim. It was kind of funny because at the first life raft, as he pulls up, he goes, hey, I'm Dan. I'm here to give you a ride.
Yeah, here you guys need a ride,
And then after he extracts all of them, he thinks his work is done. He thinks, you know, I'm up back in the aircraft. I did a good job. I got nothing left. I'm vomiting. Mm-hmm. And then the aircraft commander goes, Randy, there's 3 people in the other helicopter that the first swimmer didn't get.
Yeah, the raft, yeah. President Obama recognized the Coast Guard for their efforts rescuing the crew from the Bounty. I mean, this, again, when you think about going out into weather like that, and this is not your regular hurricane, remember, this, as we were mentioning. And it's hard to imagine what they went, the rescue, and the crew itself, that they could survive that long in those kinds of conditions to be rescued. So all the folks in the rafts are rescued, but in the tally, there are 2 crew members still missing, Captain Robin Walbridge and deckhand Claudine Christensen. Captain Walbridge's body was never found, but tragically, Claudine also did not survive. Her body was found in her immersion suit. Yep. Tell us about that.
The swimmers, it was the 3rd helicopter that went out. They did find her, and the swimmer said, make sure you put in your book that we gave her CPR the entire flight back. You know, we were trying everything, but she had been far from the ship, did have a laceration on her head, so might have been hit by, you know, the mast or rigging or whatever when the ship first went over. We do know that when the Bounty first healed over, she was able to cling to it because another survivor did the same, and she asked, being new, saying, what do I do? What do I do? And they said, crawl aft if you can. That's where the life rafts are housed and away from the rigging. And that was the last that she was seen.
Yeah. You interviewed some of the crew members who endured this tragedy. How are they coping?
Pretty well. And I think, you know, youth is on their side. They're relatively young. They're free spirits. Many are back out at sea on various jobs. They should be proud of themselves for the way they conducted themselves through this whole ordeal. And in the book, Doug and I try not to insert our personal opinions. We do at the end, though, in an author's note.
Right.
You know, we wanted the narrative to move right along, but at the end of Rescue of the Bounty, I say I think the captain obviously made the mistake, but that whole notion of calling the crew together and saying, does anybody want to leave, it sure puts you on the spot.
Yeah.
And with young people, you know, the group dynamics are they're probably not going to leave. They're going to want to be part of their peer group, their team.
At one point in the book, you write how a crew member is looking at a navigation screen that's usually filled with ships, and it's eerily empty. The Bounty is completely alone out there. No other ships are around for hundreds of miles. No one else seemed to have made that same mistake that Captain Wabridge made.
Even some of his closest friends just scratch their head. They don't understand why he did this.
There was a Coast Guard investigation into the matter. What was the conclusion?
A recklessness by the captain. Mm. And the same with the NTSB as well. It came down to just a terrible decision. And I do think a lot had to do with that schedule to get to St. Petersburg by a certain time. He's feeling, we've done it before, gotten around hurricanes, we'll do it again. But to ignore some of the facts, forget about the storm, just the facts of your pumps aren't working properly, and you've got a bare-bones crew here on a ship that's got some rot in the main timbers.
Yeah. People refer to armchair sailors as people who pass judgment on how a situation at sea has been handled from the comfort of shore, but there are leaders in the sail training and tall ship industry, some of whom knew Captain Wabridge personally, who also thought he made some very poor decisions. And
yes.
these are the common criticisms, the ones you're talking about right now.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it probably must be surprising, too, to those who knew him and respected him. And you can't help but wonder if some of it wasn't the pressures of, you know, the financial responsibilities of the ship and, you know, the public relations and, you know, kind of all of that, those pressures influencing some decisions that maybe he might have made differently had he had not those same pressures.
Exactly. I think that's so true. That was, you know, the impetus to get down to St. Petersburg.
Yeah. Have you kept in touch with any of the crew? Are any of them still sailing? Do you know?
Yeah, there's actually a crew member from Cape Cod, Jessica Hewitt, who's working down in the Gulf and is on board ships. So she was able to get beyond this trauma. A couple of the others as well. There's also a lawsuit going on from the family of Claudine Christian against the owner of the Bounty. So. Mm-hmm. Some crew members are not at liberty to talk.
Because of the lawsuit, right. The Coast Guard, of course, did a heroic job saving the lives of the Bounty crew. Has the Coast Guard ever deemed it too dangerous to embark on a rescue? It seems like in the books you write, it seems like they go out into some really awful, awful situations.
That's a great question. I have not come across an incident. I'm sure it's happened, and I'm just not aware of it. I do like the fact that they leave it up to the aircraft commander sometimes.
Right.
Because they're on scene. They know what the aircraft can take.
Yeah. One thing we didn't mention, too, with the helicopter crews, they were coming off a shift. It wasn't like they were, you know, all fresh and ready to go. They were coming on the end of their shift when this happened.
Yeah. It was a four-person crew, and the second crew, there was an interesting, just a little story, that the hoist operator dislocated his shoulder during the flight, during the rescue, because he's holding on to the cable. And a survivor said, we didn't know what happened, but all of a sudden he kind of crouches in a half-standing position inside the aircraft and runs into the wall.
Boom, to put it back.
And to put it, yeah, later I learned why, because I asked him. I said, a crew member told me you ran into the wall. What was that about?
Yeah. He didn't want to jeopardize the mission because of his dislocated shoulder.
Yeah, and the swimmer is down in the water off the hook, and that's the dangerous part.
It's amazing. Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. While you're here, we've got a few minutes left. Let's talk about a couple other books that you've been working on. Derek's Gift, A True Story of Love, Courage, and Lesson Learned. What's that about?
Yeah, Derek's Gift, I call it a cross between Tuesdays with Maury and The Fault in Our Stars. It's a true story about a Massachusetts teen who kept this incredible journal through his struggle with cancer. And the journal was so moving, I said, with so many great insights, I said, we've got to get this published. Then I said, but he keeps talking about five people in his life. What if I picked up where he left off and I followed their lives and how Derek's experience changed their life paths. And that became Derek's Gift, and it was a very different kind of book for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually you're writing about the sea and survival stories. So how did you come across this story?
A teacher up in Swampscott had been using his journal. Derek wanted his journal to be used and to be published and to be read. He said at the end of it, I want everybody to read this to get these insights of what it's like to be young and have cancer. And so the teacher had been using it in his health classroom, and he said, by far, it's the most powerful tool I've ever used. Mm-hmm. And he said, you've got to read it, Mike. And I get pitched all the time these ideas.
Sure,
usually
they're
good magazine articles or something like that. I called him after I was only 10 pages in. I'm like, what a good writer Derek was for an 18-year-old. And what little tips he's giving us for how to live our lives, because he knows he's not going to make it. And I just said, I got to do this.
What type of cancer did he have?
He had a very rare form of cancer that was in his jaw.
Oh, wow.
And then later spread. So he went through a lot, and the journal was his mission.
Mm. A couple books you've had co-writers. This one that you just did, and Casey Sherman, you did a book as well. And
That The Finest Hours is the one being made
and
into the Disney movie.
And how do you feel about that?
Oh, it's so exciting. I've been to the set, and they'll even let me be an extra as long as I don't speak. And it's been an exciting ride.
Sometimes that's sort of a bittersweet thing because, you know, I've had other authors say, you know, there'll be more people who probably see the movie than read the book. But you never know. Sometimes the movie might get people. And sometimes they change, you know, they Hollywoodize it, you know. And then you also teamed up with your daughter, Kristen, to write The Cringe Chronicles, Mortifying Misadventures with My Dad.
Well, after doing so many serious books, I needed something fun. And Kristen, she's now 26, and she wrote the book in the last couple of years, but it's looking back on her teenage years, growing up with an eccentric father, me, and how I ruined her life and especially ruined her vacations. And so she's a gifted writer, and as I'd read her chapters, I'd be cracking up, but I'd go, Kristen, you know, my memory is a little different that you caused that particular problem. And finally she goes, how about if we do this? I write the chapters, and at the end of the chapter, we have something called a dad's view, and you get to have your say of your perspective.
How you remember it.
So that the book was aimed for both parents who have teenagers or parents who have survived the teenage years, because you can see how you can look back and laugh, but also for teenagers as well, because they're going to see a piece of themselves in there of having parents who embarrass them.
Author Michael Tokas, always good to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.